Thank you. I don't know if... Can you hear me okay?
It's a little bit.
It's a little...
It's not really
bad. Let's see. Said this is very sensitive, this volume thing, right? Let's see. Does that make it there? Okay, there we go. Okay. All right. So I came from Florida today, Southwest Florida, and I wasn't sure what the weather was going to be like in Mississippi or this part of Mississippi. I just checked it on the way to the airport, and I saw that you were in the 40s here with possible lows of 25. I came from 84 degrees and sunshine. So I didn't bring a winter coat, but I guess I haven't suffered too much. I did wear socks, so I thought it might be a little cooler here. All right, so let me begin. As you know, the title of my talk is Postmodernism a Problem for Religion? And you all should have a handout, and the handout is a fairly detailed outline of the talk. I will, so you can follow along, I will let you know when we get to the different sections of the talk. So the first one is knowing and not knowing God. Excuse me. Some Christian thinkers claim that by reason, that is, by our natural power to know, we are incapable of finding out anything about God. However, they do not deny absolutely that we can know God. Their claim is, rather, that it is only by a special supernatural gift that God makes himself, by a special supernatural gift that God makes himself known to us. This gift is the gift of what we call faith. Without faith, they tell us, it is impossible to know God. This view of our knowledge of God is typically called fideism. Although among the better known Christian fideists, we can count the early Christian writer Tertullian, the French Renaissance philosopher Michel de Montaigne, and the 20th century Swiss Calvinist theologian Karl Barth. Other Christian thinkers have a different view. While they would agree with fideists that God can and does grant us knowledge of himself through the supernatural gift of faith, they would also claim that we can have some knowledge of God by reason. Let's call the Christian thinkers who take this view anti-fideists. This is probably not the best label to give them because it only defines them negatively, but I haven't been able to come up with anything better. St. Augustine, St. Anselm, and St. Thomas Aquinas are examples of anti-fideists. The teaching of the Catholic Church is anti-fideist, and I would count myself as an anti-fideist too. You can find plenty of people who will deny God's existence. Perhaps some of you here tonight deny God's existence, I don't know. This is not, however, a new phenomenon. It has been with us for millennia and predates Christianity. Although our fideist friends might, given the chance, invite atheists who believe in Jesus Christ, they would not feel compelled to give them rational arguments for God's existence. Anti-fideists, like me, on the other hand, might think it in a particular case that it would be worthwhile first to discuss with them, with non-believers, the reasonableness of believing in God. The reasons for disbelief in God have not always been the same. In the past couple centuries, some people have supposed that the natural sciences give us grounds for denying God's existence. But this can only be true if it is assumed that the natural sciences are equipped to investigate something like God. The natural sciences study what we can perceive with our senses, directly or indirectly, with or without instruments, and what we can in some way measure, that is, what we can weigh or what has weight or velocity or volume or temperature, etc. Yet God, as Christians understand him, is not a reality along these lines. We cannot perceive him in any way with our senses or measure him. Investigating God by means of the natural sciences would be like using math to deal with a grammar problem. The method doesn't fit the object. I realize that there are many people who believe that the natural sciences offer us the only reliable knowledge of reality. This is what we call scientism. The problem with scientism is that it's not a scientifically provable view. Science cannot ask whether there's anything beyond the physical universe because it simply doesn't have the means to answer the question. It is only equipped to study the physical universe. Consequently, and paradoxically, scientism itself is radically unscientific. Okay, section number two here, postmodernism. Scientism is a powerful contemporary cultural force, but I'm not here to talk about scientism. My topic tonight is another powerful contemporary cultural force, postmodernism. The question that I want to ask is whether postmodernism is a problem for belief in God. Of course, if we are going to be able to respond to this question, we will need to have an understanding of what postmodernism is and why it might pose a challenge to belief in God. The meaning of postmodernism varies somewhat across disciplines, but the differences may not be all that great. Since I am a philosopher, I'm going to talk about philosophical postmodernism. In philosophy, postmodernity names both an historical period and a way of thinking that is supposed to be in sharp conflict with modernity. From a philosophical point of view, modernity is usually seen as beginning in the 17th century with the thought of the French philosopher René Descartes and as extending into the late 19th century. Now, two caveats should immediately be registered. The first is that the relationship between modern and postmodern thought is not simply one of conflict. Certain elements in modern thought pave the way for postmodernism. Furthermore, the genealogy of these elements in modern thought can be traced back beyond modernity to the Middle Ages and antiquity. The second caveat is that some of the areas of conflict between postmodern and modern thought are also areas of conflict between postmodern thought and medieval and ancient thought. The lesson here is that to understand postmodern thought, it is not enough to compare it with modern thought. It must also be compared with medieval and ancient thought. However, I'm not going to attempt to do that in this talk on any grand scale. Instead, I'm going to do something very modest. I'm going to narrow my focus to just two central themes and two central thinkers. The themes I'm going to discuss are truth and reason, and the thinkers I'm going to discuss are St. Thomas Aquinas and Jean-François Lyotard. I will start with truth and reason. So we are now in section three, truth. There are truths that depend on us, on what we do or think, and could, as a result of changes affected by us in our doing or thinking, fail to be true in the future. For example, the rules of baseball, according to which three strikes count as an out, or the fact that to be president of the United States, you must be at least 35, or that the red traffic light means stop. We could at some point decide to make four strikes count as an out, and then it would no longer be true that three strikes count as an out. Or we could decide to lower the legal age to be president to 30. Or we could decide to use the green light as the stoplight. Let's call these sorts of truths, truths that depend on what we do or think, human truths, or socially constructed truths. Socially constructed truths are subject to the choices we make and agreements we have with each other. Many of us, probably most of us, believe rightly that there is another category of truths, truths that don't depend on what we do or think, and so that are true regardless of our doing or thinking. For example, that 3 plus 3 equals 6, or that nothing can both exist and not exist at the same time and in the same respect, or that change occurs. There's nothing about these truths that depends on us. There's nothing we can do about them. In fact, they are of such a nature that they would be true even if we didn't exist. Let's call these sorts of truths objective truths. Objective truths don't depend on the choices we make or the agreements we have. No matter what we choose or what agreements we have, 3 plus 3 equals 6 will go on being true. If you don't believe this, then try some time to create a hexagon, a six-sided figure, by drawing 3 sides and then adding 2 more, or by drawing 5 sides and then adding 10 more. You won't get a hexagon. I believe we need to distinguish a third category of truth, which I will call undecidable truths, but I will postpone talking about these till later. Now, truths are supposed to be about reality. When I say I know some truth, I am claiming to know something about reality. I am claiming to have latched onto some part of reality with my mind. If there were only socially constructed truths, then reality itself would be entirely a social construct. The whole of reality would be something we have made. It would all be like the rules of baseball. That is, it would all be subject to what we do or think. But if there are objective truths, then at least some part of reality would not depend on us at all. Some part of it would be objective and would be the way it is even if we didn't exist. If I held the view that reality is entirely a social construct, then I would have to insist that there are no objective truths. I would have to hold, for instance, that 3 plus 3 equals 6 is a social construct, which means that I would also have to hold that because of our decisions, it could change at some point in the future, such that tomorrow or next year or next century, 3 plus 3 could equal something besides 6, say 7. But we have already seen that this is impossible. So it would be foolish to embrace universal social constructivism. However, there's another reason to reject universal social constructivism. If the whole of reality were constructed by us, then we must also have constructed ourselves, the ones who are doing the constructing, since we too are part of reality. To do that, we would have had to exist before we existed, so that we could put ourselves together. But evidently, nothing can exist before it exists. Again, then, we see that embracing universal social constructivism leads to absurdity. Thus, we can safely conclude that not only are there socially constructed truths like baseball, like we have in the rules of baseball, and socially constructed reality, but that some parts of reality are objective, and so there are objective truths too. Okay, section 4 now, reason. Let's turn to the other theme I said I would like to talk about, reason. Reason has always been understood as our natural power to know. I'm going to define knowledge very simply as awareness of truth. To know that a hexagon is a six-sided figure is just to be aware that it is the case that hexagons are six-sided. Some knowledge is only probable. Thus, if I see dark clouds gathering in the sky, I know that it is likely to rain. However, it is also possible for the sky to clear up and for the rain never to fall. This sequence of events occurs frequently in South Florida, where I'm from. So my knowledge that it's going to rain is merely probable. For knowledge to be certain and not merely probable, I need to be aware that things must be as I take them to be. There are some philosophers who believe that no knowledge can be certain. The technical term in philosophy for this view is skepticism. Skeptics deny that our reason has the power to be certain about anything. Are the skeptics right? Is there nothing about which we can be certain? To show that the skeptics are wrong, it would not be necessary to demonstrate every single truth about which we can be certain. It would be sufficient to show that there are some truths one or several about which we can be certain. Whether there are other truths besides these about which we can be certain is something we could inquire about later. Now, it seems to me that we don't need to look very far to find truths about which we can be certain. Nor do we need to engage in a lot of sophisticated philosophy. We can just appeal to the three examples of objective truths that I listed earlier. It is clear that it is clear that what would contradict them must be false. Could it be true, say, that nothing is undergoing change right now? No. It is evident to me that my mouth is opening and closing, and at the very least that my perceptions are changing. It would be false to claim otherwise, so I can be certain about that. Right? There's no way to reasonably doubt that. So I believe we can set aside any worries about skepticism. I realize that given the many debates that have raged about skepticism in the history of philosophy, some people might think that I'm being too cavalier about it. I'm afraid that all I can say about this is that I'm not all that impressed with skepticism and believe that too many people are too ready to give it credit. This is not to say that many skeptics aren't skilled philosophers or that they haven't constructed formidable arguments on a variety of topics. Against either of these claims, the Scottish Enlightenment philosopher David Hume would be an obvious counterexample. All I wish to say is that the central claim of skepticism, that we can't be certain about anything, is easily defeated. I don't want you to get the impression that I think that the only kind of knowledge worth having is certain knowledge. Probable knowledge is also very important. It makes sense in many cases to believe truths that, from the standpoint of reason, are only probable. We could not live very successfully unless we did. For example, to make plans, we often need to have an idea of what the weather or traffic is going to be like, and have to go with weather predictions and beliefs about the traffic that can only be probable. To interact well with other people, we need to have an idea about how they will respond to what we say or do, but our beliefs about them will only be based on probability and not certainty. Of course, we could go on and on describing cases that show the importance of probable knowledge in our lives, but I think you get the picture. Well, it would seem that we can take ourselves to establish four key points so far. First, there are socially constructed truths. Second, there are objective truths. Third, human reason is capable of having certainty about some things. And fourth, even probable knowledge is important. So, section five now, St. Thomas Aquinas and God's existence. Let's move on then from our themes to our thinkers. These themes will return again soon. The thinker I want to start with is St. Thomas Aquinas. Thomas, as you may know, was a medieval theologian. He was a priest of the Order of Friars Preachers, also known as the Dominicans. According to Thomas, as I said at the beginning of the talk, we can know God both by faith and by reason. Consequently, he tells us that there are two kinds of theology or knowledge of God. There is, on the one hand, a theology that we can develop using reason. Thomas calls this philosophical theology. We use that term today, too, to talk about the same thing, but now we also call it natural theology. On the other hand, Thomas says that there is a theology that we can develop using reason together with faith. He calls this sacred doctrine. He understands himself to be doing this latter kind of theology. But because it incorporates reason, he also incorporates natural theology in his work. And it is Thomas's natural theology that I want to discuss tonight. Thomas would agree with the four points I just mentioned. He would agree that there are socially constructed truths, that there are objective truths, that human reason is capable of certainty about some things, and that even probable knowledge is important. Thomas believes that by reason we can know with certainty that it is objectively true that God exists, and that he has certain attributes, like goodness, wisdom, omnipotence, etc. This is what he tries to show with his famous five arguments for God's existence in the Summa Theologia, and with the treatise on God's nature that follows them. However, he does not believe that demonstrating these truths about God is easy, or that people will be able to follow these demonstrations easily. But he does think that they allow us to say with confidence not only that it is reasonable to believe in God, but that we all should believe in God. Thus, Thomas would tell us that atheism does not have any ultimate rational justification. And that's a pretty big deal, especially when you consider how common atheism is today. For Thomas, this doesn't mean that someone couldn't have very good reasons for being an atheist. What it does mean for him is that this atheism couldn't rest on irrefutable proofs. To understand the claim Thomas is making about God, we need to understand what it means to give a proof or a demonstration. It means first to give reasons or evidence for what we believe. In doing that, we are trying to show that what we believe is true. As I explained earlier, we know that something is true when we are aware that things must be as we take them to be. I can show in a direct or indirect way that something is true. So there are two ways I can show something is true, in a direct way or indirect way. I can show you in a direct way that it's raining outside by asking you to look outside, which we can't really do here. But if there are windows, I could say, look, it's raining, right? And that would be a direct proof that it's raining. If I show you that something is true because it is implied by other things that are true, then I'm leading you to some truth, not directly, but indirectly through those other truths. Think of how a detective comes to see by a series of clues that lead him to the, think of how a detective comes to see by a series of clues that they lead him to the perpetrator of the crime. So he follows, this is an indirect proof, right? So by other truths, he comes to discover the person that he's looking for, right? And so he's led to the truth that he's searching for by other truths. So that's a kind of indirect proof. Thomas's proofs or demonstrations of God's existence are of the indirect kind and arrive at God by a series of truths about the world that lead us to him. The teaching of the Catholic Church is in agreement with Thomas. According to the First Vatican Council, which took place between 1869 and 1870, quote, God, the beginning and end of all things, may be certainly known by the natural light of human reason, by means of created things, end quote. The Council cites St. Paul's letter to the Romans as one of the sources of this teaching. In the first chapter of the letter to the Romans, St. Paul tells us that the pagans, who did not acknowledge God, are without excuse, because God can be known through his creatures. Although some theologians have disagreed about what exactly the First Vatican Council intends to say about our ability to know God, Pius XII later made some clarifications in his encyclical Humanae Generis in 1950. There, Pius XII teaches that one of the things that the Council intends to say on this score is that human reason is able, without the help of divine revelation or grace, to demonstrate God's existence. I would like to walk you briefly through one of Thomas's proofs for God's existence, but I will save that till the end of the talk. Before I get to it, I want to say a few words about the other thinker I promised to discuss, Jean-François Lyotard. And here we come to section 6. Jean-François Lyotard and postmodernism. Lyotard, who died in 1998, was, as you may have guessed, a French philosopher. He taught at the University of Paris 10, Nanterre, and published over 30 books. Along with people like Jacques Derrida and Michel Foucault, Lyotard is among those philosophers most associated with postmodernism. In his book, The Postmodern Condition, which was published in 1979, he formulated what has become perhaps the most influential definition of postmodernism. According to Lyotard, postmodernism is characterized by an, quote, incredulity towards meta-narratives, end quote. On the assumption that some of you, on the assumption that to some of you that definition means absolutely nothing, let me try to explain in more accessible terms what I think Lyotard is getting at. Postmodernism is incredulity towards meta-narratives. The first part of this definition isn't difficult. Incredulity means unwillingness to believe. If I'm incredulous about something, say about snow falling in Miami, then I don't believe it. Lyotard tells us that in postmodernity, we don't believe in meta-narratives. But what's a meta-narrative? In French, the word is meta-récit, quite literally meta-narrative. Trying to define it literally will only get us part of Lyotard's meaning. A narrative, or récit in French, of course, is a story or an account. The prefix meta suggests comprehensiveness. A meta-narrative, then, would be a comprehensive story or account. The meta-narratives that Lyotard is talking about are meant to be comprehensive, but they're not simply stories or accounts. They are attempts to prove certain objective truths about large segments of reality or about reality as a whole. Lyotard calls these big kinds of objective truths totalizing truths. Postmodernists are people who do not accept these proofs or the totalizing truths they are about. It is crucial to observe that Lyotard's intention in what he says about postmodernism is not only descriptive but prescriptive. When I describe something, I'm simply telling you what it's like. When I prescribe something, I tell you how things ought to be or what you ought to do. Lyotard isn't just describing the postmodern condition, he's presenting it as how things ought to be. Lyotard holds that we shouldn't believe in meta-narratives. We should reject efforts to prove objective truths about large segments of reality or about reality as a whole. As a case of the kind of thing he's rejecting, he points to Karl Marx. Marx tried to argue that the whole of history is characterized by class struggle. This is a meta-narrative in Lyotard's sense. Presumably, Lyotard would be just as critical of Francis Fukuyama's defense of liberal democracy as the best political regime, excuse me, or with the attempt in physics to produce a theory of everything. Lyotard has a vague hypothesis about how we came to be in this postmodern condition in which we are no longer able to accept meta-narratives. But I do not have the time to discuss it here, and in any event, it would be more relevant to the topic of my talk to ask why he endorses postmodernism's incredulity about meta-narratives and the objective truths connected with them. According to Lyotard, every attempt to prove some truth assumes a set of rules that specify what will count as proof. These rules can only have force, he says, if we agree to them. Without our assent, they have no power over us. Different cultural groups and disciplines have different rules about what counts as proof or about what conditions must be met if we are to accept something as true. Americans have their rules, Koreans have others, scientists have different rules from mathematicians, and Christians and Buddhists have different rules too. On this assumption about a relativism of criteria for truth, Lyotard concludes that it's foolish to think that we can demand that people accept anything as universally true or true of some significant part of reality. All we can say is that a given truth claim is accepted by one group and not by another. Nothing is simply true and merits being accepted as true by everyone. So the postmodern disbelief in meta-narratives is fully justified, he thinks, because every meta-narrative is and must be a fraud. The truth of the matter, he would have us see, is that there is nothing but little narratives, petites récits, which are told by different groups, which we can agree to go along with or not. He has given up talking about reason in the singular and prefers instead to talk about rationalities in the plural. Each group has its own rationality, which doesn't overlap with the rationalities of other groups. For there is no reason that we all have in common by which we can know big objective truths. It is unclear to me whether Lyotard thinks that reality is a social construct, We have already seen that universal social constructivism is false. So if that is Lyotard's position, we can dismiss it without any scruples. The other possibility would be that he believes that some or all of reality is objective, but that we just can never be certain whether what we take to be true about objective reality really is true. Because we can never be certain whether any alleged truth connects with objective reality, the best we can do is reach what earlier I called undecidable truths. These are truths that might be true or might not, and we are unable ever to know which is the case. How pervasive is the postmodernism described by Lyotard? I don't know. I have no doubt that a significant part of the dictatorship of relativism decried by Pope Benedict XVI is a result of postmodernism. Surely it is also behind some of the many violent protests on college campuses against invited speakers that we have witnessed in the past few years. If I can appeal in a disagreement to a reasoning power that we share, then violence becomes the natural method to deal with our differences. As Francisco Goya says, the sleep of reason produces monsters. Does the postmodernism that Lyotard advocates pose any problems for religion? More specifically, does it pose problems for Christianity? It does not seem to pose a problem for fideism, the view that reason can tell us nothing about God and that we can only know about God through faith. But fideism seems to be rejected by St. Paul, who, as we saw a moment ago, tells us that even the pagans who did not have faith knew God. It does not appear, therefore, that fideism is a position within the bounds of Christian orthodoxy. But Lyotard's postmodernism would pose a problem, if it were true, for Christians who are anti-fideists. Thus, it would pose a problem for people like St. Augustine, St. Anselm, St. Thomas, and myself, and for the Catholic Church. However, to decide the question, we would need to ask whether Lyotard has gotten things right. Is he right to deny the possibility of meta-narratives? As you may have suspected, I'm going to argue that Lyotard has, in fact, gotten things badly wrong. As I see it, his postmodernism faces at least three devastating objections. The first and most obvious objection is that it is self-refuting. It does not seem capable of expressing itself without taking on the form of the very meta-narratives that it wishes to repudiate. Lyotard appears to be arguing that it is objectively true that every narrative is a little narrative rather than a meta-narrative. But arguing that something is objectively true about a large segment of reality is just what a meta-narrative is supposed to do. If Lyotard wants to reject meta-narratives, he can't create one to do it. The second objection is about undecidable truths. If Lyotard is claiming that all possible truths are undecidable truths, then he is evidently proposing a form of skepticism. But we have seen that skepticism is false, since there are some truths about which we can be certain. The third objection is that there are some truths whose proof does not depend on rules to which we agree. In other words, there are truths whose truth isn't subject to our choice. We have called these objective truths. And we know that there are such truths. Lyotard wants to tell us that all truths are subject to our choice, but this simply is not the case. Because these objections appear to be fatal to Lyotard's postmodernism, I believe that we can plausibly conclude that it poses no theoretical threat to Christianity. That's a very important conclusion to come to. There are some Christian thinkers who are in agreement with Lyotard's views, and believe that they are compatible with Christianity. But if Lyotard's view of things is wrong, as I think I have shown, then no one should agree with it. Unfortunately, postmodernism, despite its theoretical indefensibility, is still a powerful cultural force. Although it isn't a problem for Christianity at a theoretical level, it remains a major problem at the practical level. It is certainly worth reflecting on what practical strategies would be effective in dealing with it. However, I will have to leave that reflection for another time. we come to the last section, section 7, the first argument for God's existence in the Summa Theologiae. Now, on your handout, you'll see that I've included there not just an outline, but my presentation, my summary, more or less, of the argument. I'll get to that in a minute. But I put it there because the reasoning is a little complex, and the terms might not be easy to get a handle on, so I wanted to give you the complete summary on the handout. But I'll get to that in a moment. Before I conclude, I would like, as promised, to walk you through quickly through one of St. Thomas's arguments for God's existence. If Lyotard's postmodernist thesis were true, Thomas's natural theology would be a fantasy, for it is clearly a meta-narrative, since it claims that it is objectively true that God exists and that the whole of reality apart from him is caused to exist by him. But we have now seen that Lyotard's postmodernist thesis is false. This means that we don't need to be anxious about whether it might undermine Thomas's natural theology. That isn't to say that we can immediately conclude that Thomas's natural theology is a path to truth. That would be a non sequitur. What we can say at the moment is that it can't be challenged by Lyotard's postmodernism, since this postmodernism, being false, can't be a challenge to anything. The argument of Thomas that I'm going to lay out is the first of the five arguments for God's existence that he gives in his Summa Theologiae. He calls these five arguments ways to God, vie. The first way argues to God's existence from the existence of change in the world. The Latin word that I'm translating as change is motus. English translators usually render it as motion, but it can also be rendered as change. And in any case, I think change better captures Thomas's meaning. What Thomas wants to say is that the change that is a part of everyday experience is evidence for God. Why change should be seen as evidence for God will probably not be obvious to you. So let me try to explain Thomas's reasoning. Earlier, I gave the existence of change as an example of something about which we can be certain, that there is change. The fact of change is just undeniable. So it's something about which we can be certain. If change is something about which we can be certain, and it is likewise evidence for God's existence, then we can say that God's existence is certain too. In its very basic form, Thomas's first way could be presented like this, and this is what's on the back of the handout there. Change always involves a relationship of dependence of the thing changed on the cause of the change. If we consider everything that changes, the whole set of things that are changed, we can ask about what it is that originally introduces change into that set. Nothing in the set could have originally introduced change because everything in the set depends on the cause that changes it. Put differently, everything in the set points beyond itself to something that causes it to change. Therefore, the whole set points beyond itself to something that originally introduces change into it, and that is thus the first cause of change. Now, if you're a logician, you might think that this commits the fallacy of composition, but the fallacy of composition is only against illegitimate inferences from parts to wholes, not all inferences from parts to wholes. But put that aside. Maybe you, if you're a logician, you might want to talk about that during the Q&A. Let me just restate some of the things that I said. Put differently, everything in the set points beyond itself to something that causes it to change. Therefore, the whole set points beyond itself to something that originally introduces change into it, and that is thus the first cause of change. This first cause cannot itself be changed by anything, for then it would not be outside the set, but a member of it. The first cause, then, is an unchanged changer, as it is more typically designated in English, an unmoved mover. Thomas says that this unmoved mover is what we mean by God. And because we can show that the unmoved mover exists, we can show that God exists. That's the first way in a very basic form. So this is the bare bones of Thomas's argument. To make it more intelligible philosophically, more details would need to be added. First, we would need to say why change needs a cause. Thomas explains this with the concepts of act and potency. Second, we would need to say why everything that changes depends on a cause that is other than itself. Here again, the concepts of act and potency aid the explanation. Third, we would need to say why the unmoved mover deserves to be called God. There are a number of reasons why Thomas thinks this makes sense. One reason is that the unmoved mover, because it is the ultimate cause of change, must be what Thomas calls actus purus, or pure act. A reality that is pure act cannot be acted upon by anything else, which means that it is unchanging. Because it is unchanging, it must be outside of time and so eternal. As pure act, it has the power to actualize whatever can be actualized, which is just the same thing as saying that it can make exist whatever can exist. If it can do that, then it must be the creator of if it can do that, then it must be the creator of everything, there's a typo there, I said or everything, creator of everything that exists apart from itself, and be all-powerful, omnipotent as well. So we can begin to see that the unmoved mover is a reality that has the attributes that we understand God to have. It is unchanging, eternal, the creator of everything that exists apart from itself, and all-powerful. Of course, we can understand God to have other attributes besides these, or we do understand God to have other attributes besides these, but a reality that is pure act would have these other attributes as well. So as I said, this is just a quick run through Thomas's argument. I would be happy to discuss it further during the Q&A, which we can do now. Thank you. Questions? Objections?
You can't get to God in the Abrahamic sense just by reason. That requires faith. Yeah. You can get to something. So if you go to St. Paul's letter to the Romans, first chapter,
right?
When he says that the pagans are without excuse because they know God, he's not talking about them having the faith of Jewish people. Right? He's talking about them knowing God in a way other than faith. And how does he say they know God? By the things that are created, he says. So by reason, right? But he doesn't think that they therefore know the God as he has revealed himself to the Jewish people, right? The Abrahamic God. He thinks they know God in part, but not completely. To know God completely, faith is required. Yeah. Yes?
I've always been kind of astounded by what Auguste Comte once said. He said, he was an atheist, and he said that he didn't consider himself an atheist because that would be taking God seriously. So if God doesn't exist, then you shouldn't call yourself an atheist, because if it doesn't exist, then you should just ignore it, right? So isn't atheism, in a sense, actually a belief in God that they don't want to believe?
That's interesting. I'm not aware of that idea from Tom, but Sartre says that he and I suppose that Nietzsche has the same idea too. You can find it in Nietzsche as well. And there's important insight that they have here, and that's that. When people may say they don't believe in God, God that we can know through philosophy, or the God that we can know by faith, but they still treat something like God, right? So they still act as if there is a God. Nietzsche says grammar. For some people, it's grammar. The reverence that they show for grammar, right, is the reverence that other people would show for God. So they're still treating something as the most important thing, right? And but what, and here's what I think is impossible, what Nietzsche and Sartre say we can't do is do that. We can't treat something as if it's the most important thing, because then we're not really living our atheism. But I want to say that's impossible, because everyone makes something the center of their lives, right? Everyone makes something the center of their lives, which means to treat something as if it were divine, right? The highest good. So to me, it seems that if religion is about treating something as the highest good, then everyone is religious, right? Everyone is religious. We just name the highest good something else, right? So I think that atheism can't be lived practically. You can say you're an atheist. So there's a kind of theoretical level you can claim to be an atheist. But everyone is going to treat something as the highest good. And so everyone is religious in that sense. Thank you for your comment.